Near the beginning.
Oh. This is Paul Morlitz from the Oral History Project. Today is Tuesday, December 16th, and I'm in the home of Lois Greenfield in Hill Farms District. And we'll begin by asking Professor Greenfield if you could just briefly describe your childhood and your early years of schooling.
I didn't know what you wanted me to comment on there. I grew up in Chicago, left home at the age of 18 or 19 because the war was on. And I wanted to, this explains my tie to engineering too. The Curtis Wright Corporation of Columbus, Ohio offered a year of study to women who wouldn't be drafted to study engineering and take the place of the men that they thought were going to be drafted. And so a friend of mine put my name down and I went to the University of Minnesota for a year, studied engineering, then went to Curtis Wright in Columbus, Ohio and worked as a junior engineer.
Okay, how'd you end up in Minnesota?
That's where Curtis Wright sent you to study engineering before you went to work there.
And did any family members and or teachers influence the direction of your studies when you were younger in Chicago?
It was just always a given that I was going to go to college. Neither of my parents had been to college. My father had taken occasional courses because he had a CPA, but my mother didn't even go beyond elementary school. So it was very important to her that I have education. And my sister too, my older sister.
Did any instructors in high school or college influence
you? Well, the instructor in high school that influenced me most was my math teacher. I took 4 years of math in high school. And he had also been the teacher of the man who was associate dean of the College of Engineering at that time. And he came to work here. And then that's how I got hired, because he knew I was in Madison. And I got hired to work on the project that the engineering was dealing with, which was identification of bright kids in high school and trying to get them to come to the university to study engineering. Although they did broaden it to try to get them to come to the university, it didn't matter what they wanted to study. But that's how, that was the connection with my background. And my high school math teacher was here.
Were you considered a talented and gifted high schooler?
They didn't have that classification then.
Oh.
But like in elementary school, I skipped three times, so that meant I was bright.
Skipped three grades?
It was half grades in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
It was half yearly promotion, so it was a year and a half ahead that I was.
Okay.
And I skipped fractions and still regret it.
You skipped fractions?
In fifth grade math, it was when they introduced fractions, and that's one of the grades that I skipped and had to learn on my own. But I made it up. I can do them now.
Oh, that's good. And did you have any early career aspirations when you were
I think everybody was going to be a doctor.
You thought you were going to be a doctor?
Yeah. But then I decided that wasn't what I wanted. And I guess I didn't really have a designated career. Certainly not engineering, because it wasn't considered to be a career for women at that time.
Right. Any reason why you didn't want to be a doctor?
Well, I decided I didn't want to spend the time, and I wasn't really interested in it. It's just kind of a group thing. Everybody wanted to grow up and be a doctor. And when I said I wanted to be a nurse, my family said, no, smart girls don't study nursing. They become doctors, but I didn't want to be a doctor. So I just kind of drifted in college for the first 2 years and got a general education.
Sounds familiar.
You know, very sympathetic. When they say they don't know what they want to do.
So, at the University of Minnesota, you studied what type of engineering?
Aeronautical engineering, because we were going to go to work for Curtis Wright that built airplanes.
Okay, and Curtis Wright is based in?
Well, it had a plant in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
And that's where we went after we finished studying at the University of Minnesota.
And how long were you at the University of Minnesota?
About 10 months. And I earned 60 semester hours of credit.
In 10 months? Wow.
Yeah, we went to class 40 hours a week. It was intensive.
And what year was this?
43, I started February 43.
So they tried to get rush everybody through during the war, huh?
Yeah, the girls, because they knew we weren't going to be drafted. And they thought a lot of their engineers were going to be drafted out of their plants. And they were preparing us to be junior engineers to take the place of the men that were drafted. But the men weren't drafted, and we went to the plant anyhow and entertained ourselves by riding the bikes back and forth among the... So anyhow, after I was there for almost a year, I quit and went back home because I didn't think I was accomplishing anything. It was fun, but it wasn't contributing anything.
What's meant by a junior engineer versus just an engineer?
Well, it's you get a lower salary and you're not capable of doing as much. Because after all, I only had 60 semester hours. And engineering degrees are usually at least twice that at a minimum. But the thing that I got credit for when I went back to the University of Chicago was for the calculus that we took. They had us divvied up according to our math background. And I had had 2 years of math in college already by the time I joined up with Curtis Wright. And so I did get some calculus and got credit for it at Chicago. All the other engineering courses were not credited at Chicago because they didn't have a college of engineering. Hmm.
And why did you decide to go back to University of Chicago?
I was there before I went to study with Curtis Wright. I had one semester there. And then I left to go to the University of Minnesota.
Oh, okay.
And I always planned to come back to Chicago.
Did you grow up in that Hyde Park area? Or?
No, I didn't.
What part of Chicago?
I grew up on the north side of Chicago.
Oh, okay. And so when you got back to the University of Chicago, what course of study did you pursue?
Well, I got a degree in psychology because I was interested in it, and that looked like the thing I could most quickly get a bachelor's degree in. So I studied psychology.
That was one of the main reasons you chose psychology?
I was interested in it too.
Right.
But I got my degree by 1945, having started college in 1940 with 2 years of junior college.
Oh, okay.
I had 2 years of junior college and then I started at the University of Chicago. And then I left to study engineering and to help win the war. Curtis Wright. A friend of mine put my name down and I was accepted.
Well, would a friend just put your name down without you knowing about it?
No, well, the reason it's important that she put my name down is because she put hers down too, and she was not accepted because she discovered she was an enemy alien at that time. She'd been born in Germany, always thought she was an American citizen because she came to the United States about 2 months after she was born. And to find out in the midst of a war that you were an enemy alien was kind of discomforting to her.
Huh.
But anyhow, she's the one that put my name down. I didn't hear about it because I wasn't taking math at the time.
And why did you start out in junior college?
It was cheaper. It cost something like $7 a semester. And the University of Chicago must have been about $100 a quarter then. So it was a big difference.
Did you always have the intent on going on to a...
I always had the intent of going to the University of Chicago because one of my favorite cousins was there and talking about it all the time. Thought it was the only place in the world to go, so I got that impression. The only place in the world to go.
Was it a highly competitive school to get into back then as
well,
it
they
is
were
now?
They were particular. But I don't think I would have had any trouble. I just saved 2 years of tuition by going to the Wright Junior College, which was a city college in Chicago.
So you had some of your credits transferred then to the University of Chicago?
Yeah, all of them transferred.
Oh, okay. And, go ahead.
Because a lot of the teachers there were graduate students at the University of Chicago. In the junior college. And so it worked on their system with the survey courses. They had required survey courses in physical science, biological science, humanities, and social studies.
And at the University of Chicago, you worked as a research assistant while you were also juggling classroom work. What research project or projects did you assist with?
Well, my research area was problem solving, and I worked on that. I was I was at Illinois Tech at the time, teaching psychology there, after I got my bachelor's at Chicago. I don't know whether all this got into the material that I gave you, but I was at the University of Chicago and left, and then went to work for Curtis Wright in Columbus, then came back and got my bachelor's degree, and then I got my master's degree directly, partly because I was working on this research project, and if I were enrolled in school, I could live on the South Side at University of Chicago and not have to go an hour and a half each day by public transportation, one way from my house to the University of Chicago. So that's why I got a master's degree initially, so I could be a student.
How did you become interested in problem solving?
Well, the first job that I had as a research associate was with Ben Bloom, who's an illustrious researcher in the field of psychology, educational psychology. And we were trying to find out, he was on the board of examiners of the University of Chicago, and he was curious to find out why kids who should have been making A's on these exams that were given at the end of the year survey were failing, some of them, and some of them were doing well. So we had a project going where I asked them to think out loud as they did the questions on the exam. And my master's thesis came out of that. But that's how I started in the area of problem solving, trying to find out why kids failed exams when they shouldn't have, and why some of them passed when they should have.
Okay, so you got your master's degree at the University of Chicago as well?
Yeah.
So your work as a research assistant?
It's just a title, really, so that they could pay me.
Okay.
But I was doing research in problem solving.
But that was undergrad when you were doing the research, correct?
Well, I carried it through and got my master's degree.
Right. So you liked it so much that was?
Yeah, it was fascinating to see how people think and solve problems.
Is that why you went on to get a master's?
Yeah. Also to have a place to live on the South Side. I was a student and I lived at International House there, which I couldn't have lived at if I hadn't been enrolled as a student.
Okay.
An hour and a half each way is 3 hours out of your day, you know.
Yeah.
So it's worth working that much.
Did they have the elevated train back then?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Is that what you would have taken?
I took the L downtown, and then I got on the IC, the Illinois Central Railroad, because that was faster than the L from the rest of the way, from downtown to the South Side.
Oh, okay. Before going on for your doctorate, as you said, you spent the time working as a research assistant at the Illinois Institute of Technology.
I was actually teaching a psychology course.
Oh, you were teaching a course at the Illinois Institute of Technology?
But I was listed as a research associate. I didn't have a PhD then. And one of the professors in the department said if I ever really wanted to do anything, I needed a PhD in my field. So then I was accepted at Berkeley and went there.
Why Berkeley? Did you apply to a bunch of different schools?
I applied to Berkeley and Stanford.
You wanted to go west?
I wanted to go west. I wanted to go someplace I didn't have any relatives. Don't tell anybody that. But that's why I went to, and Berkeley responded first, so I went to Berkeley. I was admissible in either place, I'm sure, because my record was good.
Do you ever wish you would have gone to Stanford instead?
No.
You enjoyed Berkeley?
I enjoyed Berkeley.
And so at Berkeley, what was your focus of study there? And
educational psychology is what I got my PhD in. At Chicago, I'd gotten a bachelor's and master's in psychology, but the area that I was interested in at Berkeley was under educational psychology, School of Education. So that's where I got my degree.
And your dissertation topic?
It was problem solving.
So you continued that the whole way through?
I did more particular aspects of it. But yeah, it's an interesting area. There's still a lot to be discovered. Although I haven't done anything in that area for a long time.
And when you were a doctoral student at Berkeley, you also worked as a teaching assistant?
Yeah. in psychology classes.
Did you enjoy the teaching aspect?
He didn't do much teaching. He prepared a little topic for each week, but the teacher in charge of the course really did all the teaching, and then you had kind of a question and answer period when you had the kids for 1 hour a week.
Similar to
it was a big class of 500 kids, and they divvied them up into sections of about 25 to 30. So as a teaching assistant, I had a couple of those sections.
So you didn't do much actual
research, no.
Or teaching, really. I mean, you
did
more question and answer sessions.
Yeah. But that's a way to teach, too.
Right. Well, being in front of the class, did that sort of give you a sense that you might enjoy being a teacher?
I just liked trying to get people to understand what they were reading about. They had questions.
Okay. And did any professors or fellow students at the University of Chicago or Berkeley influence you in any significant ways, or did the professor you worked under at Berkeley, did you go to Berkeley because of that, the professor's
no,
work?
No, I didn't go for that reason. I went because it was a good school in the field of psychology. It was just all their graduate departments in education and in psychology both were pretty good.
Okay, so there was no professors there that really influenced your...
Well, there were some outstanding professors there, but they influenced the way I looked at things, but didn't influence my direction because I knew which way I wanted to go.
Okay. So, you headed back east after you got your doctorate from Berkeley.
We went, I got married.
Okay.
And my then husband got a job at Portland, University of Portland Medical School, which was in Portland, Oregon, and so we went there. And then he got a job here at Wisconsin, so we came here. That's how I headed to the Middle West. In those days, women followed their husbands.
Your husband was he had a
PhD psychologist major.
Oh, okay. He was in your program with you at Berkeley, or?
Yeah, I met him in a class in dynamic psychology. My first year there.
Okay, so then your husband
got a job
at UW here?
Here, yes.
Was there a period where you didn't work at UW and he did, and you just, did you get a job with him in addition, or did you?
I got a job in addition, yeah.
At the same time?
Shortly after, when I knew where I was going to be.
Okay, could you describe your hiring process, or?
Well, you just go knock on doors. But the hiring process here was due to the fact that my high school math teacher was also the math teacher of the associate dean of the College of Engineering, and they were doing a research project trying to get students who were bright to come to the University of Wisconsin College of Engineering. They did broaden that. It's turned into the program that's now called Talented and Gifted, but wasn't that when I was in it. But that's how I got started in the College of Engineering.
Wait, you said your high school math teacher became associate dean?
No, he was also the math teacher of the associate dean.
Oh,
Dean Marshall at that time. And we were trying to identify bright kids and get them to come here. And so I had them do problem solving out loud, and we could sort out the kids that we wanted to try to influence and tell them something about the College of Engineering.
So you based your decision on who was bright by their problem solving strategies?
Well, we also had test scores on them. But yeah, it was partly how they solved problems. We were looking at that.
Could you describe some of the differences in the way gifted?
Well, a simple-minded thing was it. They weren't necessarily so gifted, but they were smart. They read the directions before they started working the problem, and some of the not-so-bright kids never read the directions. So, for instance, on a multiple-choice test, when they ask you for the best answer, that doesn't necessarily mean the true answer, because they may all be true, but you want to pick out the best. And the bright kids, having read the directions, knew what they were supposed to do. Whereas some of the other ones would come to the first one and say, that's true, I take that one, and it would be the wrong answer. So one of the things we did was develop a checklist as to the differences between the good, successful problem solvers and the non-successful ones. And then I tried to teach some of the less successful ones how to do better problem solving.
Okay, and so these are still high school kids, or these are...
But that time that was college kids.
They're freshmen and engineering students?
Yeah. Or,
okay, because you said you were trying to get gifted students to come to UW.
Yeah, but then after they got there...
Could you explain that process of trying to channel gifted students to come to UW?
Well, it was really kind of informal, because they really couldn't do what they were planning to do. They were just exploring avenues for trying to influence these kids. And I never actually influenced them directly. I just had them solve problems and analyze their problem solving, put it in a report about the kid that had other information about the kid.
Okay. You began working at UW-Mass in 1956, correct?
Yes.
And you were a project associate for the Engineering Experiment Station.
Yeah, that's where Dean Marshall was.
He headed
the experiment station, and that's where my high school teacher worked. And so that's where I worked.
So Dean Marshall hired you?
Technically he hired me, but I got the job because of my high school math teacher, who recommended me and knew I was in Madison. I was here already before I started working there.
And so what were your daily duties as a project associate for the experiment station?
Well, mostly I had appointments with these kids to have them think aloud as they solve problems. And we analyzed that and gave them back a report, had a report in their folders. I didn't think to get any examples for you, except for that one about reading directions. But people who are successful problem solvers, who make good grades on exams, solve problems differently from kids who may be just as bright, but don't seem to have a method for working on multiple choice tests or true false test questions. And that's one of the things we're exploring. We were working to make the kids better problem solvers, but also to have better tests made up as a result of the information that I was finding out about what caused kids to be misled. Some of it's delivered on the part of the examiner, the person making up the test, but some of it they didn't realize they were doing and shutting out kids for the wrong reasons.
So that was a pretty vital role you were playing then.
Well, I thought it was.
Do you know if other engineering schools, other universities had the same sort of approach? So someone in your position that analyzes?
Not that I know of.
So it was fairly innovative then?
I guess so. Never thought of it that way.
So Kurt Wendt was dean of the College of Engineering when you were hired, correct?
Yes.
Could you just talk about Dean Wendt for a moment? If you would, how effective did you think he was at dean, and what were some of his accomplishments?
Well, it was a long time ago, but he was really one of the most effective administrators I've ever run into since then and before then. One thing I think that was very good about him, he'd let you do what you wanted to do and back you up. And people were, I think, willing then to try new approaches. Because he was, you know, he wouldn't let you louse anything up. He kept track of what his people were doing. But he gave them freedom to pursue it, what they wanted to do. And Dean Marshall was his associate dean, Dean Marshall, the man who was the reason I was hired.
Okay, and so, right, and so as... Kurt Wendt stepped down, then Marshall became dean.
That's right.
Could you describe his deanship? Well, or maybe any contrast comparisons to Wendt?
It was kind of a different style. I'm not sure that he kept as close track of people, but then he had more people to keep track of, as Dean Wendt had. I don't know how to put into words the difference in his style. But he was eager to let you be innovative too. I just think he was doing more things and didn't keep as close watch on everybody as I had the feeling Dean Wendt did.
Oh, you think Marshall was just busy with so many other things?
He was innovating, for instance, a junior year abroad program in the College of Engineering, which was unheard of. You know, engineers supposedly can't learn languages. That wasn't true. And that was one thing that he influenced Dean Marshall, a junior year abroad for engineering students, which was a most successful program.
And you spent a period of time under Dean Bollinger, correct?
Yes.
Could talk about Dean Bollinger?
Well, I had been here long before Bollinger came, and he didn't interfere with me at all.
Did you know him? I know he was a student at...
I didn't know him as a student.
You didn't know him as a student then?
I knew him first as department chairman. He was chairman of mechanical.
You didn't help him with his problem-solving skills?
No, not at all.
Okay, any more comments on his effectiveness as a dean?
Well, I think he's effective. As I said, I was most impressed by Dean Wendt of all the administrators that I knew.
Okay. And in 1959, you became involved with engineering administration as an assistant professor.
Yeah.
And you worked in this capacity for 11 years. What were some of your administrative duties, and whom did you work for?
Well, the engineering freshman office. The College of Engineering had a program where there was a man who was dean and who was freshman advisor. And he couldn't, you know, there were like 600 or more freshman engineers. So he had people helping him, advising and counseling the freshmen. That's where I worked. Dean Shields was the dean. He was an assistant dean when I started working in the freshman office. And I worked with him and did what he did.
Dean Shields?
Shields, S-H-I-E-L-S.
And what were some of your just daily duties, day?
They set up appointments for kids who needed counseling or who needed some information about what classes to take or who, in some cases, who were having trouble passing their classes. And I taught problem-solving skills to some groups at that point. I think from the questions that you asked, being in administration was just a title so they could pay me.
Oh, okay.
But you could be doing a number of different things as a research associate.
Okay.
Including not any research.
Okay, in 1970, you started teaching engineering graphics under a one-quarter appointment, in addition to your
They figured I had to be teaching something or I couldn't be an assistant professor. And I'd had some drawing when I was studying engineering. So I learned something about descriptive geometry and taught it.
So you sort of had to reteach yourself the...
I never had had a course in it. So I would sit in on the class, somebody teaching it in the morning, and then I'd teach it in the afternoon. You know, I was familiar with drawing.
You mean that very afternoon?
Yeah,
after you just learned?
Drawing and descriptive geometry is the theory behind the engineering drawing. And I knew the engineering drawing, so it was just learning some of the theory. It's a theoretical approach of study of points and lines and planes and space instead of drawing a machine part.
Okay. Did you enjoy teaching drawing?
Well, I liked teaching other things better because I felt a little insecure with this learning in the morning and teaching in the afternoon.
Yeah, I imagine.
It's not the best way to go.
No, it's not. So... when you weren't teaching drawing, you were still
working with the freshmen.
Okay.
And I could understand some of the problems some of them were having with drawing. I had good spatial sensitivity. too, which is helpful in drawing. Some of the kids didn't. But they don't even require drawing in some of the courses in engineering these days.
Yeah, I don't think
you can do it on the computer.
Yeah, the CAD system.
Yeah.
And in 1976, your teaching a little doubled to where
I went to full time.
Okay. Then you were half time teaching drawing, and the other half teaching.
Helping the freshmen.
Okay, and you also, you had on your resume that you began teaching technical writing.
Well, they
General engineering was in a service.
It was a service department. It taught, it didn't have degree students, it taught drawing courses, and then when technical writing became a requirement in almost all of the departments, they took over the teaching of that because they had people like Gretchen Schaaf in the department, who was there for a 10-year home.
And
so they needed somebody, so I learned it and taught it.
Did you volunteer to teach it, or did they sort of?
Well, I was there. I don't think I volunteered, but I said I wouldn't be unwilling. It's, you know, it's fun to learn something new. And that wasn't completely new. I could write a reasonable letter. I just had to know how they did it in industry, which I learned.
So when I think of technical writing, I think of like a pamphlet for how to operate your lawnmower, how to put
it
together.
It can be a pamphlet, it can be letters, it can be a whole bunch of things having to do with whatever it is the plant is manufacturing.
So when you say letters, that just threw me. I didn't know.
Oh, no, business letters.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, you put what you're dealing with in the first paragraph because that's where people generally look first, things like that.
Okay, but you also taught the kind of writing where, you know.
No, I just taught technical writing.
Right, but isn't that like
it includes regular writing, yeah.
Oh, okay, but isn't it also like put bolt A and slot?
Well, that's directions on the graphic, generally.
Okay.
But it might include that. If you're writing the procedure down, certainly that would include a form of technical writing.
So, I mean, did you find it difficult to teach technical writing, or was it just another type of writing for you?
It was just another type of writing for me. It was interesting because it had a different emphasis. You know, it's nice to keep learning things.
Right, I agree. And I also have here, you taught Introduction to Logical Thought and Logic Circuits.
Well, that was something I got interested in. Jim McNary, who's recently deceased, or I guess not recently, was teaching this logic circuit board thing, and he was teaching it in the summer, and I kind of sat around and helped him when I could, and learned how to develop logical thinking and show it on this board that has lights going flashing and stuff like that. It was a course that was opened for freshmen. Jim McNary was teaching high school when he first started working in the college summers, and it was just something else that was interesting to learn. He gave the lectures and I kind of acted as his teaching assistant at first.
It just to learn the ropes and then.
Yeah.
You took it over and taught on your own.
I never lectured.
You never actually lectured. Logical thought.
It's logic circuit boards, you know.
Okay, but I got the logic circuit part of it, but the logical thought aspect.
Well, that's an extension of it.
Okay.
Well, what does this mean when you apply it to what you're thinking? Which is related to my interest in problem solving. So it's not so far apart.
Huh, okay. Of all those different type of courses you taught, did you find any of them particularly difficult to teach, more so than others, or?
No. I liked the freshman orientation class best of all, because I thought I could function there most as an educational psychologist. That course, which was managed by other people before I took it over, they'd have the chairman of each of the degree-granting departments come and talk to this class of freshmen. they tell him salary and stuff like that. And it got to be a bore. So I asked young engineers who'd just gone out to work to tell about what they did, which was much more interesting to the freshman students than what the chairman of the department had to say about it, and much less repetitive. As a matter of fact, I just got a request for a recommendation from a young man who was a minority, who told what it was like to be a minority in engineering. Came back and talked to my class in freshman orientation.
Do you remember any of the things he said, or?
Not really. It was 20-some years ago.
Okay.
And this is a big span of time, you got to realize that.
So what you're describing is that's the General Engineering 100 course?
Yes.
And you sort of redesigned it?
I had different kinds of speakers. I don't know whether somebody looking at the schedule of classes would know it was so redesigned. But it was. It had younger people talking about what they were doing.
Right.
And introduced some other topics that they hadn't covered, besides salary and requirements and formal stuff.
And you also told me that this class was also intended to help freshman engineering students decide if they truly wanted to be engineers, and if so, what type of engineer?
Yeah.
Can you explain
The problem in the class was kids who were bright and good in math in high school were told by various teachers, oh, you should be an engineer, you're good in math. Well, that's not necessarily the only thing you should be good at or interested in to become a good engineer. So we helped sort out these new young engineers talking about what they did and what they liked to do, gave the students, the freshman students, a broader idea of what it was going to be like to be an engineer. And some of them decided that was just their cup of tea, and others decided on the basis of the information that they got, they really didn't want to be engineers, they were going to do something else with the math that they were good in.
Did this course also serve the function of like helping them decide, do I want to be a chemical engineer or electrical engineer?
Yeah, by what the person who was.
Okay.
That
by the speakers that came.
By the speakers that came, and we also had discussion sections where they could ask questions and talk to people on a one-to-one basis.
So I take it this wasn't a graded course.
Well, they got a satisfactory or unsatisfactory grade, which was based in some part on attendance.
Or if they ultimately still were indecisive.
Well, I had them write a paper, which meant there were some 500 papers I had to read. But it depended what kind of questions they were asking themselves. If the paper was unsatisfactory, they didn't pass the course.
And what type of paper were they asked to write?
To tell where they were in their thinking about what they wanted to be when they grew up.
Huh.
And if they wanted to be an engineer, why? And if they didn't want to, why? Some of them thought that they'd be demoted or something if they didn't want to be engineers. But I tried to make that clear that it was a perfectly reasonable choice for some people not to go into engineering.
So it reminds me of the talking out loud problem solving.
I suppose. That's my approach to
a lot of
things.
That's a general theme of your...
Yeah, to ask people what they're thinking about.
Academic career. Generally, though, what were some of the concerns of these freshmen, just that they were in this course, that they were just getting in the way over their head, or...
No, it never really was over their head, but some of the descriptions of some of the things that people did, they didn't really like, or they liked tremendously. There were different reactions. And some of them thought it was going to be held against them if they decided they didn't want engineering. And we made it clear that it wasn't. And by answering certain questions like this on their papers, I could tell whether or not they were understanding what I was trying to present. If they weren't, I'd call them in for a conference, try to explain one-on-one.
Did you ever calculate any attrition rates?
Well, generally, about 50% of the kids who start as freshmen finish with an engineering degree. If you give them enough time, they don't finish in 4 years mostly because they had more credits required then. When I first started working in the College of Engineering, I think they needed like 156 credits to graduate. in engineering, and in letters and science it was 120. So it generally took them longer.
And do you have the roster that I put on there?
No, there wasn't a roster on it.
Oh, there wasn't?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, could you discuss any of your fellow general engineering faculty members for a moment? Any ones you work closely with?
Well, I work most closely with Dean Shields, who was the freshman advisor, who also taught drawing courses. And then when he retired, I worked with Fred Lydell, who became the freshman advisor.
Okay, and did you team teach any courses with...
No, I didn't.
Okay. During your tenure at College of Engineering, your research interests have focused on engineering education, such as effective teaching methods for instructors and problem-solving techniques for students, as well as student advising and guidance. Could you discuss the aspect of effective teaching methods? How did you get involved in that? That's sort of the flip side of problem solving.
Well, I was named to the Committee on Engineering Education, and ultimately I was chairman of that committee. And we tried to present programs to the faculty in engineering that would tell them some of the things that would help them be good teachers. Currently, Sandy Corder in engineering, whose name I gave you as a possible reference, runs that. And she has a better situation now because it's now required. And it wasn't required when I tried to get people to come to the classes. But there are certain physical techniques like don't talk to the blackboard. Just simple-minded things like that.
Were the faculty members very amenable to suggestions?
Not many, no, but the teaching assistants would come. You know, it was never a required program, which it now is, for new teaching assistants to try to improve their teaching qualities.
Okay. In 1961, you wrote an article entitled, Why Do Freshmen Fail in College?
I couldn't find that article because I don't know.
You don't remember what you said?
No, I don't really remember what I said. But probably, I suspect it was because they weren't interested and weren't studying.
Because they weren't interested in studying?
They weren't interested in engineering, really. They just got there by accident, and they weren't studying. Or it was, what happens is you get kids who were very bright in high school and things were very easy for them so they didn't learn to study. And when they got to college, they had to scramble to learn how to study because things were not that easy for them. And some of them didn't scramble hard enough or fast enough.
Yeah, imagine the transition from high school to a engineering program is...
It's pretty hard for the kids who were bright and always had it pretty easy in high school. Depends what the high school expected of them in part.
Did you notice any differences from like where the students were from? Like,
no.
If they're from private schools or out east, if they had an easier time, or
was
it more individualistic?
Most of the kids who come from the college, who go into the College of Engineering are Wisconsin residents.
Mm-hmm.
Kids who come from out of state aren't usually choosing engineering. I don't know.
So it's more just on an individual basis?
Just on an individual. I tried to do a study one time, but it didn't come into anything to find out where they were from or where they got the best education preparation for engineering here, but I didn't come up with anything. And I didn't have a lot of time. And that was before computers became the way to go. The information had to be gotten out on each little person's record, written in longhand someplace. So I didn't have much time to do it. But I never got anything formal out of it.
And your publication record reveals a number of articles about methods for, again, channeling gifted high school students into engineering programs.
A lot of the recent ones are about women in engineering.
Okay, we'll get to that. Were your suggestions implemented by the College of Engineering through your literature?
Sometimes somebody would do something different because of what I'd written. But the faculty, you know, were teaching the way they had been taught. A great many of them were, and they weren't interested in changing. They thought they were doing just fine.
And even though you tell them otherwise.
Well, I didn't say they weren't doing fine. I said they ought to try this or that. But if they didn't, they didn't. There was no compulsion. Could we stop for a minute? One of the things you've got to remember in all this is that I functioned not as an engineer, but as an educational psychologist on the faculty of the College of Engineering. So I was interested in these things.
Okay, so for a period of time, engineering was one of the few disciplines at the UW which had programs geared toward improving teaching skills.
Well, a lot of the individual assistants. Departments did. Like economics had a good program for their new teaching assistants. And when I was on the committee on undergraduate education, which was a college committee, a campus committee, you discussed with other people what they were doing in their departments to try to improve teaching. One problem that engineering had that I didn't do very much about was they had a lot of non-native students teaching engineering who understood the engineering but had a hard time expressing what they thought because of their language problems, which was a difficulty we never solved.
So they didn't have ESL programs back then, or did you try to help some of these non-native speakers with their English?
Not really, but point out to them that they needed help, and that ESL program didn't get started until a few years later after we'd started trying to help the foreign students.
Can you explain how this teaching assistant program evolved?
Well,
Were you responsible for it, or was it already there?
People were always concerned that the teaching assistants do a good job. Individual faculty members were more concerned than some of the others who didn't care, just so they had teaching assistants. You know, they dragged them in. But we tried to point out to people that things could be improved. And if the faculty member stressed it, then the teaching assistant did it. But it was up to the individual faculty member more than to anybody else.
What was your specific role in this program?
At one time I chaired the Committee on Engineering Education. I don't remember what the years were. And we ran programs for teaching assistants, and that faculty could come to but didn't very much take very much advantage of it.
Did you personally conduct some of these?
No, I organized it and got people who were experts in various fields to do things for them, to explain things, to try to present the information that they could use.
So you organized it, and then did you design any of the methods?
No, not really. I knew a lot about them, but made sure that they were presented, and people took what they could from it. The way it's run now, it's required of teaching assistants and new faculty, I think. Although you don't require anything of anybody at this university. And the teaching level, I think, has improved over time.
What do you mean by that last comment?
What?
You don't require anything of anybody at this university.
Oh, you know, you can't really make any faculty member do anything you don't want him. He doesn't want to do.
You think
that's academic freedom.
Oh, okay. You didn't mean to UW specifically.
No.
Oh, okay.
I think it's probably true other places, but this is the only place I've really been.
Okay.
And I think people are more independence-minded. Somebody once explained to me the difference between having a department chairman who's elected by the members of the department an department head who's appointed by the dean and has a much more I'm your boss role than somebody who's a colleague that's elected by his constituents. There's a difference in attitude.
Oh yeah, I imagine there is.
Yeah, but we have department chairmen elected each year, each year.
You serve as chairperson for the Planning Committee for Honors Programs in the College of Engineering.
That was a sadness. I was chairman. A lot of the other colleges had honors programs. LNS did and Ag did and so on. But the people that were in engineering said, engineering is an honors program as it is, so we don't need a special honors program. So I got slapped down with that. And they didn't want to do it. The faculty in engineering said it wasn't necessary.
But you felt it was?
Yeah, but I didn't persuade anybody.
So that program didn't last very long?
Well, it was a couple of years that we were trying, but it never amounted to anything.
So you can't take honors classes in the College of Engineering now?
No.
They consider all their classes to be honor, yeah, an honor to take?
Sort of. They can take honors classes in letters and science, like in math or chemistry, kids, but there's no honors program, unless it's changed and I haven't been told about it.
And you also served as the chairwoman for the College of Engineering Freshman Year Committee and the committee responsible for engineering course instructor evaluation forms.
Yeah, we developed that in the Committee on Engineering Education and made it available to everybody. That's another thing you can't require, or you couldn't then, to have everybody fill out teacher evaluation forms. But people began to use them for promotion to tenure, so then they were more interested in doing it. But when it first came out, some people were willing to try and other people weren't.
Was it your idea to have evaluation forms?
Yeah, well, it was a group thing.
It was the committee's...
I don't even remember it. I might have introduced it and they supported it.
Do you know if other departments at the time in the university had course evaluation and instructor evaluation?
Yeah, a lot of them did.
Because I know now it's
now it's pretty routine, but it wasn't then.
Yeah, and they publish all the results.
Yeah, and they didn't do that at first.
I wonder how much of a incentive that is for instructors to...
Well, for people wanting tenure, it's important. Because in order to get tenure, you have to show that your teaching is good.
Really, even in engineering?
Even in engineering, yeah. Teaching, research, and service.
What was the freshman year committee exactly?
Well, to look at the freshman year, which was largely the same across the college, to see whether or not we wanted a freshman year common to all the departments. That was one of the big things that we looked at. And they never could agree. For instance, chemical engineers wanted the harder chemistry course for their students, and other people required only one semester of chemistry or just two semesters of the easier chemistry.
You mean the other, like electrical and mechanical?
Yeah, and chemical engineering wanted 109-110 series. I don't know whether that's the same course they require now or not. Which was 5 credits for both semesters, and the other course was 4 credits one semester and 5 the other. So we never could get a really common first year. But we hashed it out and some things changed. One of the things that was changed, I think, was each department for a while there had its own orientation course instead of taking the one that everybody took. And that was helpful, but then they stopped doing it because it required teacher time and there was a crunch of too many students and not enough time. So the freshman orientation then was no longer required, whether it was a departmental course or a general course.
So the freshman committee, does that still exist today?
I don't know. Probably.
Can you give me examples of issues that faced for example, the course instructor evaluation form.
Well, getting people to use it in the first place.
Were some faculty members opposed to it, or?
They weren't opposed to it, but they just didn't want to bother with it. They didn't think it contributed anything, because they weren't going to listen to the results anyhow. You know, some people who teach in the College of Engineering teach because they like teaching. And some of them teach because it gives them time to do their research and gives them context to do their research.
From your feeling, what is the balance at the College of Engineering? Do you think there are more that are interested in teaching or more that are interested in research?
More that are interested in research. But, you know, I haven't been in the department for a while now.
Right, I haven't when you were there.
I think most of them were more interested in research. The ones that liked to improve their teaching were unique.
Which brings up a point of, as you said, general engineering faculty were the only ones that didn't conduct research.
Well, they don't have a degree.
What's that?
They don't have a degree. Some of them conduct research.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, it's just sort of funny,
it's
the inverse of the situation for most.
Yeah,
you guys teach, are known for your teaching,
yeah,
but not your research.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if there's times where many of the general engineering faculty wish they could have been involved in research more.
I don't think so. As a matter of fact, you didn't show me the roster, but most of the people in engineering, general engineering, were not PhD people. So they hadn't gotten a research degree.
My impression is, though, that a lot of the engineering faculty didn't have PhDs either during this period.
When Dean Wendt was dean, he only had a bachelor's
degree.
Right,
exactly.
He had an honorary doctorate from someplace or other. I don't remember where. But he only had earned a bachelor's degree, but he was a bang-up teacher. And he did some research that went over a period of like 25 years, I think, with one. He was in engineering mechanics, that was his home department. Did something with concrete.
The 100-year concrete?
Maybe, but yeah, if that's still around.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Yeah,
we saw it the other day.
He was there for, I think, about 50 years of it, because he started it as a new faculty member before he became dean.
So basically what you're saying is, for people to take your research seriously, you needed a PhD.
Well, to be a researcher, that PhD is a research degree.
Right, but I mean, you can be a good researcher without a PhD.
Yeah,
and still
you can, but you're not as likely
not
to
as
be
credible.
Interested in it. Yeah.
And people won't.
Well, some people just look at your degrees and evaluate you that way. I always thought it was interesting in the College of Engineering, although most of the faculty were PhDs, they were addressed as Mr. So-and-so, never Dr. So-and-so, as they are in some other places, some other colleges.
Not professor.
Well, professor, but Mr. rather than doctor.
Between the faculty members.
Yeah.
I think that's more of humanities,
because
more in like English and history.
Maybe. In letters and science.
But then again, I can't really comment because I'm not in there. You served on the Engineering Education Committee, the Public Relations Committee, the Human Rights Committee, the Long Range Educational Improvement Programming Committee, as well as a host of other committees not mentioned. There's a long list of them on your resume.
I served on committees in the college and on the campus.
Any comments about your service on these committees?
No.
Any of them stand out in your mind?
The Undergraduate Education Committee probably was the thing that I thought was most important. Try to improve teaching for undergraduates. I don't know how much we did.
You don't know how effective you were?
Yeah.
What was the Human Rights Committee? What did you do in that?
I don't remember that. Is that the one that Cy Hallett chaired? I don't know. I don't remember what that was.
Public Relations Committee?
In the college? That was to organize Engineers Day, which still goes on. It honors alums. Each department picks an alum, and they give them a citation.
Okay. And Long Range Educational Improvement Program Committee sounds like that's up your alley. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but I don't remember anything called that.
Yeah, it's sort of a long name for a committee.
And I don't know what that was.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I threw away a lot of the stuff that I had about the committee and so on.
Yeah, I imagine it's hard to remember a lot of these. You did serve on the Faculty Senate, though.
I was elected from the Drawing and Descriptive Geometry for 1 2-year term.
Okay.
That's when they had organized the Faculty Senate. It was newly organized.
That year? It was the first
couple,
year? Of the,
no, it was a couple years after that, but early on.
Do you recall any issues that the Senate faced during your incumbency?
The only thing I remember was trying to establish what grade was the best grade for giving credit for pass-fail courses, C or D. And they changed it from D to C. That you had to make a C in order to get credit taking the course pass-fail. You know, they translate the grade.
Right, right. So if you got a D, that was considered a fail?
It was going to be after we got that passed.
Is it still the same way today?
I don't know. I think so. But I have been out of touch with that for a long time.
Can you recall any other issues you dealt with in the Senate?
No. That was the Education Committee.
You invested a great deal of time in the freshman summer orientation advising for registration program, otherwise known as a SOAR program. Do you have any comments on your many years of involvement with this program?
Well, it was fun to be involved in it because the kids were starry-eyed and bushy-tailed from high school, and this was their introduction to the college. And you could help them decide how many credits they should carry, what courses they should carry, what they could profit from most. And they signed up for courses then. Now I think they actually register for them. But at that time they signed up for them and they could go home and think about what you'd told them and change their mind or solidify their decision. But it was a nice orientation. Some people tried to scare the freshmen in that. We didn't in engineering.
Oh, so you were responsible just for SOAR for engineers?
Yeah.
Okay. My impression was there was a campus-wide SOAR program,
well,
regardless of what the student is
they
is
might
doing.
Run it that way. They did initially because there weren't enough students. And people that did SOAR early on did whatever group they happened to get. But when I was working on it, we just got engineering freshmen.
Okay. And do you recall about how many years you served on?
A lot of years.
Did it change over time? Did you notice changes?
No, it changed after I left.
Can you describe the changes that you know of?
Oh, I don't know.
For better, for worse?
Well, different. I don't know. I don't know what I can say about that. I don't know how it changed exactly. Except that they then, after we finished with them, in other years they actually registered for their courses, and I thought it was better the way we had it, so they still had thinking time before they registered. But then that was before there was computer registration. This is when they had to run to each department to get a signature in order to get enrolled in the class.
Yeah. Boy. That would have been a hassle.
It was a hassle.
You can just do it from lying down on your couch.
Yeah. but there are some advantages in reviewing this process. You get all the information one day and then you register that same day is the way it's done now. But otherwise, you got all the information and then you could go home and talk to your friends who've been here and think about what you wanted to do. Maybe make a more reasoned choice of courses.
So you think now with the technology, it's almost too quick of a process.
It might be.
And maybe actually doing the legwork of going from building to building and meeting faculty.
Well, that was hard to do.
Right, but that might have also,
triggered some other things.
Triggered some decision-making factors, maybe.
Yeah.
And you were a member of a number of professional societies for both education and educational psychology. Any comments on any of these societies and their
The one that I was probably most active in was the Engineering Education Society, which had people in it who were engineering professors in general, who were interested in educational aspects of it, not just the technical side of what they were teaching, but rather how they taught it. And we ran programs across the nation.
Would you have meetings?
We had meetings and talked about it. And I found a few kindred souls who had a degree in engineering and then had gotten an advanced degree in education and were interested in teaching and doing things to improve teaching across the colleges.
Any other professional societies come to mind? That
well, I belong to the Society of Women Engineers, but was never active in that. And mostly it was the...
which is because you weren't really an engineer.
Yeah. Well, but the one I was most often active in was the engineering education.
Okay, now I'm going to just touch on women in engineering for a moment here. In 1974, you developed, quote, Introduction to Engineering, a summer program for high school girls.
Yeah.
Can you discuss how this program evolved and how effective this program was in meeting its goals?
Well, it began to be important to have women come into engineering, and so that was the way we tried to do it. We had summer program for 1 week. We had 2 1-week programs. And one of the gals that was in one of our early programs, I think has become a dean someplace, is very active in engineering. For some of the kids, the girls, it was the first time anybody had ever presented engineering to them as a career, and we had people demonstrating in the different departments what they did, and influenced some of those girls to go into engineering and some of them to stay out of engineering. But it was a small group. So then we thought we could do better if, when they left the high school, those girls, there was nothing left of the program for engineering for women. So we ran a couple programs for high school faculty and to try to tell them what engineers did if they happened to be female, or male for that matter, because a lot of the teachers didn't know what engineers did. They never encountered them in their own undergraduate lives, because they were in colleges of education. And then we developed a program for women who would come into engineering, which still stands in the college, I think. And some of the women students go out and talk to high school kids during the semester. I used to do that too, go out and present a program and for engineers and have all the engineers that came with me be female, things like that.
Yeah, I noticed you'd go to like East High School, West, yeah. Memorial.
Yeah, and take some engineering students with.
What would you do, just go in individual classrooms or have
Well, sometimes it was a classroom if a teacher invited us, or sometimes it was a whole group if the counselor at the school invited us, depending.
They would just organize all females in the high school to come or just only those that...
Well, it depended on what the individual teacher did or thought was important, or counselor. Early on, it was just important to get them to consider that girls could be engineers. And then later on, when we had more girls in engineering who could go out and talk about it, their teachers or somebody in their family would encourage them to study engineering. And we tried to support those efforts. And we did increase the number of women, the percentage of women in engineering at the college. Never got to be 50%.
What did it get up to by the time you left?
Well, got up to a high of about 18%, which was pretty good from 1%.
When you started there, when you started at UW, what was it, 1%?
1 or 2%, yeah.
Do you feel that you personally had were responsible for a lot of that dramatic increase?
Well, at least I was the impetus for getting the girls to do it themselves.
Okay. In 1977, you along with L. Remus.
Linda Remus.
Linda? Uh-huh. Linda Remus designed, quote, Why Not Engineering, a program intended for high school science and math teachers, counselors, and female students. How effective was this program in meeting its goals?
It wasn't very effective, but it was a good idea. But the timing was a little bit off. We were ahead of our time in trying to get that to go.
What do you mean the timing was off?
Well, people weren't ready. That was, you know, before the word was abroad that women could be anything they wanted to, even if it was a technical man's field, which engineering was considered up until then.
Like about what year would this be?
No, around then.
Or around
when we started. 77,
right. Mm-hmm. I said that. Former Associate Dean John Asmuth was quoted as saying...
Yeah, where was he quoted as saying that?
This was in a Capital Times article. Mm-hmm. I don't think we engineers know how to present our work properly for girls, end quote. Could you comment on a statement, if you wouldn't, discuss what you believe to be more effective ways of reaching female engineering students?
Well, I can't comment on the statement. I'm not sure I know what he meant by that. That they didn't know how to present their work properly for girls. I think you present it the same way, and you present it the best way that you can. Doesn't matter whether it's male or female. And I think the best way to reach female or prospective female engineering students is to have female engineering students who are dynamic and think that the thing that they're doing is the best thing that ever happened to them, that they're studying engineering, have them go out and talk to these kids or invite the kids to follow them around for a day or so, see what school is like, what engineering college is like, and how hard they're going to have to work.
Yeah, you think that would be...
I think it would dissuade some from going. No, it would be a challenge for some of them.
Yeah, that's true.
If it would dissuade some of them, they should have been dissuaded. Initially, it used to be very hard. I remember one woman in chemical engineering telling me that whenever nobody in the class could answer a question, then the teacher would say, "Well, Kathy, what do you think?" Because he knew her name, because she was the only girl in the class. Which meant she always had to be prepared, and she was an honor student.
Well,
at least, that's the way I tell it.
But so given your knowledge of problem-solving skills, you don't see any gender differences in...
No. Never can see any gender difference.
In ways of tackling math, engineering type problems?
No, I didn't really formally see any differences. Individual differences, yes, but not gender differences. I think if you're going to be a good problem solver, you're a good problem solver.
Okay.
A successful problem solver.
Because, you know, there are obviously tests have shown, you know, boys perform better in math.
Well, and because they take more. They still do, but not nearly as much more as they used to.
Plus there's sociological factors involved too, I think.
Yeah. Well, but I think those are changing. You know, it isn't, "Oh, I'm a girl, I can't do math anymore." No girl would dare say that now.
No. Again, you said the number of women engineering at UW has increased dramatically. 1% when you started up to about...
1 or 2%, yeah.
And today it's about...
I don't know what it is today. I haven't checked. It went higher than it was, and then it started down again when nobody was pushing it. It went up, you know, I guess you could say when most women were saying a woman can do anything, and then they were proving it, that a woman can do anything. So it was higher then, and then went down a little bit. But it must be at least more than 10% now.
Did you see any other females get tenure when you were there in the School of
Engineering? Gretchen Schaff.
Gretchen Schaff
was a tenured professor, but she was in our department, and she was the one that taught technology, science, interaction kinds of courses, and technical writing courses. She was a magnificent teacher. She died very young.
Okay, well, you don't know of, like, chemical, mechanical, electrical?
Well, I think there are some now in each department.
There are some now, but only recently?
Well, the last 10 years, say. You know, I've been retired since 69.
Okay.
So that's...
It was the year I was born.
Well, I won't comment on that.
So since there women were a growing presence in the College of Engineering, can you comment on the accommodations the College of Engineering made?
Well, the only thing that I really influenced, and this is not to be taken seriously, I did a survey of the bathrooms in the engineering building, which is the thing that's known as Engineering Hall, and there were not enough bathrooms for women. There were women's staff bathrooms, and the students felt they couldn't go in there. They said women's staff only. And there were men. There were faculty washrooms and men's rooms, and the faculty were all men except me, and I wasn't in that building. And so I kicked up a fuss. I did a survey, and we got a woman's bathroom on each floor at each end.
What do you mean you did a survey?
I did a survey. I went around and read the doors.
Oh, I thought you meant a formal survey, like,
no,
would you favor her?
I just went around and looked and marked where there were bathrooms. And like in Engineering Research Building, there was a woman's bathroom every fourth floor and a men's every second floor.
What is it now? Do you know?
I think
is it equal?
I think it's equal.
Yeah.
That building and in the engineering building, there are no longer women staff. There's a woman's room at each end of that building and on each floor. There just weren't enough bathrooms because there weren't very many girls.
Right. It's quite an accomplishment, though.
Well, they used to tease me and say I couldn't come into that building because I had taken away men faculty washroom in that building. I got kidded. They didn't want to let me spy.
You served as faculty advisor to Women in Engineering Student Committee and the Society of Women Engineers Student Chapter.
Yeah, the Women in Engineering Committee turned into a Society of Women Engineering Chapter.
Oh, okay, it's the same.
That's a regular professional Society of Women Engineers.
Okay, well, as faculty advisor, could you comment on any issues that were presented to you and maybe advice you gave or how you helped the committees resolve them?
Well, I don't know of any problems, but both groups were interested in getting more women to come into engineering and performed they gave talks at various schools and held programs. I don't know of any specific difficulties they had except the bathroom. But that was when it was the Women in Engineering group, not Society of Women Engineers. It was early on.
So for a while it was probably almost like a
support group.
Group,
yeah. For the women who were there.
There probably weren't more than what, like how many were in the chapter? When you could be more than what, 10, 15?
Maybe that many active. It depended. You know, the enrollment in engineering has gone up and down markedly. And when there were more students, there were more girls.
Do you have any idea how the UW compared to other engineering colleges across the nation as far as
the
reception of women? And
the one school that did a much better job with women students was Purdue. And Purdue had When we had like 15%, they had 25% females. And they probably, I haven't talked to anybody from there for a long time. They probably still have a lot more than we do.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, probably because it's known as an engineering school.
Right.
They, if you want letters in science, you might consider Purdue, but ordinarily wouldn't. You'd go to one of the other schools.
So you don't think they did any more active recruitment of women?
Well, they had more. They had several full-time people working on recruitment of women and running programs for women. And we had me working in my spare time at some of these occasions.
Okay. Now we're at your retirement.
Okay.
As we sit here now. when and why did you decide to retire?
I was old enough. I reached 65 and I retired.
In 1969?
Mm-hmm.
And have you worked for the college?
And also I was beginning to have Parkinson's and stuff like that, my health. I could have stayed out until 70, but I didn't feel up to it.
Have you done any work for the College of Engineering since your retirement?
I worked part-time for a while to help them in the freshman office.
Doing
counseling and talking to individual students.
Okay.
Same thing I've been doing before.
And since retirement, you've continued to be active in encouraging women to explore the still male-dominated field of math, science, and engineering.
We call them non-traditional rather than male-dominated. They're not traditional for women. They still aren't, although there have been more women in engineering and more women going into other fields.
Comment, if you would, on your involvement with conferences like, quote, Expanding Your Horizons and Retooling Strategies for the Future.
Expanding Your Horizons is a program. I'm still on the advisory board for that. I volunteered to do it. Now it's being run for 7th and 8th grade girls to introduce them to math-related careers, largely engineering and some of the sciences. And out of that, the people who came with the girls, because they were too young to drive, and were teachers or counselors, and said, why don't you have a program like this for us? So that was the Retooling Strategies program. It was run for mature women who were interested, who were either undereducated or uneducated, who were interested in pursuing something more. And we tried to get them to come into engineering.
So did you design these?
I personally didn't, but I was involved in the planning boards of both of them.
Okay, so and
I had input.
They're both ongoing?
The Retooling Strategies is not, because we couldn't find anybody who had time to do it or support from a department to do it. So just the Expanding Your Horizons one is still going on. Once a year we have.
How successful do you think Expanding Your Horizons?
We'd get more kids than we could accommodate. We could take maybe 150 and we'd get like 300 requests.
Wow. Okay, well, in closing, do you have any comments you'd like to make?
No, I'd like to hear how disconnected this interview was. If you have a better picture of what I've done in engineering and engineering education.
I'm sorry?
I'd like to know what the result will be, and also how much you know about why I was active in engineering education. Whether it makes sense to you. My life.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it does to me.
All right, that's good.
Okay.